Welcome to History Talk, produced by Origins, a project of the Public History Initiative and the Goldberg Center in the Department of History at The Ohio State University. The American philosopher John Dewey once wrote, "History which is not brought down close to the actual scene of events leaves a gap." Our goal with Origins and History Talk is to fill that gap and help make for more engaged citizens. We hope you enjoy what you find.
Welcome to the inaugural relaunch of the Origins podcast. I'm Patrick Payandi, one of your co-hosts, and I'm joined by the dynamic Leticia Wiggins, the other co-host.
Hello, everyone. All right, in this episode of History Talk, we have three guests right now. First, we have Dave Hadley, history doctoral candidate and author most recently of America's Big Brother, A Century of U.S. Domestic Surveillance, which is found on the origins.osu.edu website. Say hello, Dave.
Hello.
Next, both the editors of Origins have joined us. Steve Kahn is a professor of U.S. history who blogs on Huffington Post and The Chronicle, among other things. So say hi, Steve.
Hello.
And third but not least, we have Nick Breifogel, who is a professor of Russian and environmental history.
Hello, hello.
All right, let's get right to it. The first question, and we'll start with Dave here. So not to bring out the, you know, Fox Mulder, Dana Scully in all of us, but one of the first things that should maybe be addressed here is, were any of you that surprised when Edward Snowden leaked these documents? And maybe second, about the apparent capabilities of the U.S. intelligence system to collect all this information. Were you actually that surprised that when this came out?
Well, I'd have to say I wasn't actually that surprised with some of the initial discoveries. I think as the summer progressed and as more came out from what Snowden was leaking, is I did get surprised at how far reaching some of the NSA programs were, especially most recently, right before the article was published, actually, it was the revelation that they had been, in addition to this, you know, semi-legal framework, that they'd also just been straight up breaking into the Google and Yahoo kind of cloud interface, and that there's even in the PowerPoint presentation explaining how they do this, there's a little smiley face written in by the presenter making it to demonstrate, like, this is where we're tapping into the system, smiley face. And so that did surprise me, that first off, that they'd be willing to do that and be so kind of cavalier about that.
I was surprised by a couple of things, and I guess I'm trying to figure out whether there's a distinction between the scale of all of this, whether that really is something that is different than what has gone on, as you point out in your article, Dave, for at least a century, whether the digital world makes the scale of this so enormous that it really is qualitatively something new for us. So I was certainly surprised by the scope of all of this, the gratuitousness of some of it. I remember enough of the old Richard Nixon and Watergate hearings to remember that there were at least political reasons why Richard Nixon went after the people he did, even though it was entirely illegal. A lot of this stuff just seemed arbitrary, and why bother? I was also surprised by the figure of Edward Snowden himself, that a man with a pretty unusual educational background winds up as a private contractor with access to this top secret material. I wonder how many Edward Snowdens are out there in this, because it isn't just the employees of the CIA or the NSA. It's apparently a whole world of outsourced private contractors.
Security contracting is a huge industry in the United States. And the fact that Snowden was able to access as many files as he did wasn't just that he had access to all of those files, but while one of the points the NSA makes is, well, this information's secure and we collect it, but we don't look at it without a court order. Yet Snowden was able to get this material because shortly after he began working at the station in Hawaii, he basically talked to some of the other employees there into giving them his passwords, as his explanation was, well, he needed that to do his job involved with IT. And so it's not exactly the kind of, you know, highly secure location that we might think of from like a kind of popular culture representation of the NSA.
Yeah, and one of the things that emerged during the height of the Iraq War was just how much of the American military's operations had been outsourced. And at one point, there were even more private contractors in Iraq than there were American military personnel. And that raised some questions, probably not enough questions, frankly, about what that means for a democracy to essentially be outsourcing its military like this to profit-making enterprises. And I think those questions arise here as well.
And this, for me, I mean, when you talk about surprise, the greatest surprise was that there was this
mid-level, lower-level guy who had access to all this material. I mean, extraordinary to me that someone in the NSA wouldn't have thought to themselves, please, we should protect all this material we're gathering, legally or illegally, because they clearly know they were gathering some of it illegally, as the smiley face attests. But, I mean, how this random guy who, you know, he's a young man, not much experience necessarily, and suddenly is able to get... So that for me was an enormous surprise. What didn't surprise me is that we were collecting all this data. I mean, I think that we have such a long history in the United States of data collection and this sort of thing in all sorts of different ways. I'm also just struck by the technology of it all and the fact that, I mean, we really shouldn't have any pretensions that anything is private anymore. I was struck just the other day, we were taking photographs on my wife's iPhone, and the iPhone not only organizes the pictures in it by date, but by location in which it was taken. So somebody at Apple knows where we were on that lovely Sunday afternoon while we took those pictures, and they knew that we changed locations on that Sunday afternoon. And so, the idea, whether it's Apple or Google or whoever, I mean, and so the notion that anything we do digitally is private strikes me as unsurprising in any sort of a way.
And I do think that I think it's an interesting issue, the level of privacy that we would have today in the digital world is that obviously a lot of information about us is collected and sold, quite, openly so in order to, advertise this. If you go on Facebook and you notice that there's, something advertising to you, chances are that that's part of an algorithm that is designed based on your viewing history as to what you'll get at, which leads to some disturbing questions as to why, in some cases, you're getting some of those advertisements. Is what were you possibly looking at that could have gotten to recommend those? Yeah.
This is a family broadcast. Yeah. Train this in.
Well, I'm not saying anything about what I have been recommended to, but part of that distinction is that those records, while being held by a lot of different people, I guess it's, are they being held, is it less disturbing if they're being held to sell you something that you have the choice as to whether or not to buy, and that they are periodically erased just because these private entities don't really want to invest in the infrastructure to save them over this period of time, mm-hmm. whereas the NSA has put, a lot of effort into being able to save just a tremendous amount of data every day.
Right. Kind of tying into this, one thing I'm struck with is how upset some people are and somehow not upset a lot of other people are when the story originally broke. And it's interesting, there are a lot of people who are incredibly wary of the government collecting information from emails, for example, but as you all mentioned, they're perfectly comfortable with Google or Facebook already having all of that information and other information too. So, but why is there this discrepancy with what we are okay with people having access to?
I think part of it ties into the idea of a lack of surprise. I think that there's a kind of groundwork laid for this that people expect government to be doing something like this in this particular era. After 9/11, after the earlier revelations about the NSA's more blatantly illegal program under George W. Bush, I'm not sure how much of a surprise it is anymore. So it's kind of these revelations came out on, kind of prepared ground, I think might be a good way of putting it, mm-hmm. that there had been some, hints about this coming forward. And so I'm not sure how many average Americans would have been either surprised that this was happening or worried about it based on the justifications of counterterrorism. That if, people are saying, well, this is what's necessary to prevent another 9/11, I think that a lot of people are willing to give some leeway to the government in terms of counterterrorism.
It seems to me there's kind of two reasons why we see part of this difference. I mean, I think what you have to say about people accepting that, along with so many other restrictions on rights that we've experienced since 9/11, that this is just one and that we see it as necessary. But, I was thinking a couple of things as to why we see this kind of discrepancy. Partly, I think that you see a difference between how people approach Google or Facebook than how they do the government, in part because Americans, or at least some Americans, have real discomfort with government, and that there's a long and storied kind of tradition of being anti-government and worried about government, and government's always in your face and doing this, and that this sort of association of any kind of state agency or government agency as being bad inherently is something that is that's deeply inbred in our society. And so we might trust Google or Facebook in part because, well, ultimately all they really want to do is make money. well, that's fine. The government has potentially, in the minds of many, I think many people, all these other nefarious types of things that they might want to be doing with this information, which I think we don't associate with Google. I also think that part of the difference, part of the reason we have a discrepancy between businesses and private actors and the state is the question of legality, in the sense that while part of what the NSA was doing was legal, part of it was legal through the FISA courts, part of it wasn't. Now, ultimately, what Google, Facebook, all this data collection they do, it all has to be legal in some respects, or at least we haven't discovered that they've been somehow illegally collecting data. There is the sort of sense that the NSA not only was doing something that was pretty extraordinary in terms of the volume of data collection, but was doing much of it illegally and unconstitutionally and this sort of thing.
So, Dave, do you think this is also maybe has a technological explanation? And what I mean by that is, in the good old days of domestic spying, somebody had to break into
those days.
Exactly.
I miss those days.
Somebody broke into your house and tapped your phone, and they put a little bug. That's what they called it. And they put a little bug on your phone. And so in that sense, when people would discover this or when news about this would come out, it really did involve a kind of physical violation of your private space in a way that maybe playing on the internet doesn't in quite the same way. It somehow doesn't feel as invasive as when they're taking pictures of me through my bedroom window from a van across the street. Do you think that's at work?
I mean, that would make a lot of sense to me. I guess what I would be careful in trying to, just for myself, come up with some kind of grand explanation explaining like the American reaction to this is that I think part of that technological change is a very important one, and that we are more and more used to surveillance. And it's also something that's, I mean, it's represented in popular culture a lot that we've seen before, this kind of idea. And if you look at, some of this post 9/11 popular culture, a lot of it focuses on, a dedicated government agent with wide ranging powers who's, acting in your interest.
Yeah.
That it's an interesting counterpoint to the people who still have greater suspicion, I would say, and who are more taking a kind of heritage from the 1970s. That there's a smaller group that's protesting this that is kind of bringing up the 1970s, the reasons to distrust government. But I think the larger reaction is very much more of a post 9/11 reaction. Mm.
Bringing us back a little bit to that kind of international angle, after the story originally broke, it came out that the U.S. had been spying on foreign leaders, including high profile ones, right, as we all know, including Angela Merkel, among others. At the same time, the U.S. has alliances at varying levels with many of these countries that the U.S. had been spying on. And so have these leaks hurt America's standing in the world, especially since President Obama ran on a platform of restoring the country's reputation?
I think that they're going to make alliance diplomacy a lot more awkward in the near future, especially, the Germans are a major player internationally, and that's probably not going to change anytime soon. And so the fact that, not just that the NSA was spying on Germany, but that they were directly tapping into Angela Merkel's cell phone, an actual personal slight that she'd be feeling. And it's actually one of the more worrisome aspects that it's unclear whether or not Barack Obama knew about this or not. And he claims that he didn't even know, which, it'll be up to future historians to determine whether or not that was true or not. If it is true, that's somewhat disturbing that surveillance on that high profile a figure was not something that the president himself knew about.
Either way, it's problematic.
Yeah.
Either he knew about it or he didn't know about it. And there's no good answer. Right? There's no. That's right. That was actually one of the things that did not surprise me about go back to the first question we dealt with, in the sense that nations have always spied on each other. And so we shouldn't be altogether shocked that this was going on and that it isn't still going on. It hasn't gone on in all kinds of different ways. I think you're right that the level of personalness seems, as I said before, gratuitous. That we did this because we could, not because it served any larger interest. And I do wonder. I do think that it will make, as you call it, alliance diplomacy more difficult in the near term. I suspect not altogether in the long term. But that points up another issue that I think is worth thinking about, and I think may explain why some of the people who are upset about this are upset about it, and that is the tremendous continuity that you talk about in the article. I think that it underscores just how difficult it is to put Pandora back in the box. Administrations come, administrations go. This was true for our nuclear policies. This has been true for a lot of things, especially since the Second World War. We have created a machine that goes of itself.
At a certain point, I mean, it would just... It's of a size that would make, you know, real direct supervision a difficult thing. I mean, the NSA is over 100,000 employees, and it has, you know, billions of different types of communications that it intercepts. And so, you know, in that sense, you could say that it's a very difficult to keep a close eye on it. But I think the foreign element, what's particularly interesting about it, is how the NSA's foreign activities can also impact the domestic side. That there's not this really clear divide necessarily, in that, you know, we know there's cases where they got around issues with domestic law at home by essentially asking our partners in the United Kingdom to do it for us, and then they'd pass it along if it was something we wanted to know. And we, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, have essentially since World War II been part of the kind of informally known as the UK-USA agreement that's essentially making a very strong, concerted, allied intelligence effort. But spying abroad can also now lead to information at home.
Yeah.
You know, the internet isn't, you know, entering data on Facebook in the United States doesn't guarantee that that's going to be saved on a US-based server.
Yeah. And that distinction that has been central to American spying between what goes on somehow domestically and what is international, that line's always been blurry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that's what the FISA court was created to try and address, of these points where foreign intelligence activities intersected with domestic ones. But the idea is, well, we want to be able to spy abroad. We think that's important and necessary. And so what this is going to do is try to create a framework in which we can do that espionage abroad. And then the court is supposed to implement what's called minimization procedures, so that it minimizes how much of an impact this has on actual U.S. citizens. But the FISA court, in a lot of ways, is kind of a compromise between, you know, strong intelligence and, at the time, you know, strong Cold Warrior types and those who wanted greater control over the NSA, right, over the CIA.
I think this distinction between domestic and international, which is crucial in some ways to this whole story, is also one that kind of speaks to how others outside the United States view us. Because the very fact that, I mean, you asked the question earlier about, you know, what impact does this have on America's standing, and this whole question of it's going to be harder to, you know, to create multilateral, bilateral agreements and this sort of thing. I'm not sure it's going to have much of an impact. I mean, I think ultimately the U.S., you know, most countries who are paying any attention are enormously distrustful of the intentions of the United States. I mean, I think we in the United States tend to believe that we're the good guys out there, but that's not how much of the rest of the world looks at us. And this is one, you know, the case of the of Angela Merkel is a classic example of where we, the things that we do and we do on a regular basis suddenly brought to light. But folks around the world know that we're doing this, maybe not to the degree, but I mean, I think that, you know, the sense that I've received from friends outside of the U.S. is that, you know, they shrug their shoulders, they sigh. It's just another moment of the U.S. doing what the U.S. is going to do. And because we can, because we're big kids on the block, and so we're allowed to do that. But it's also just another example for people around the world of how we play this very hypocritical game, that we believe in one set of laws for people inside our country, and we believe in another set of rules for those outside the country, as if we're that much better than everybody else, that our rights should be protected, but nobody else around the world should have their rights protected. And it really... The hypocrisy of that is plain to the rest of the planet, particularly when we go around with our hyperbole about being, you know, being this great bastion of democracy and you know, these kinds of ideas and ideologies of what we stand for, freedom, democracy, all these sorts of things. Well, freedom, democracy for us, but not for other people.
And I would like to point out, in terms of that this is a sense that what a lot of people do, is that it's not as though the United States is the only person,
exactly,
the only country. Obviously, it's not a person, sorry. The United
it's not
States,
a corporation.
Well, not yet. The Supreme Court may vote on that soon.
The United States is not the only country that does this kind of surveillance. And so, you know...
Well, and exactly. I wonder if this distinction that we've been talking about here is sort of domestic versus international, and how do you draw a line that separates that? Is that a distinction that other countries also make? If I'm a British citizen living in England, do I have... Is my Google email supposed to be treated differently than if I'm a foreign national that Britain is spying on?
Well, I'm not sure that... I'm not sure what Britain's what the average British approach to this would be. Mm-hmm. But I know that, you know, from their intelligence community and from the kind of controls that their government is willing to put on, they in some ways have a more broad-reaching ability to keep what they're doing secret. Like, they can still try and, you know, kill stories more directly, and they could do that for longer than the United States. And, you know, they also have an intelligence apparatus that kind of grew up not like the United States, well, not like the CIA, in which it was a lot more covert and private. It has a much longer tradition. And so I'm not sure that they necessarily would be surprised either at what their country's been doing.
Seems like there's this long history of people involved in intelligence circles kind of just doing what they want. And this isn't unique, as you say, to the U.S. But lately there's been a lot of talk about legislative reform or oversight of the NSA. And so do we think this is doable? What makes us think this might be doable?
I think, well, one of the things is I'd like to clarify is that while some of these activities, I would say, are done more almost on autopilot than necessarily as, you know, them making their own policy, it is important to see that the overall control is that there is executive control. The question is whether the executive will rein it in. And I think that we can go back to the last time the United States had this major investigation of our intelligence activities, which was the Church Committee in 1975.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit.
Frank Church kind of opens up, Frank Church, Democratic senator from Idaho, kind of opens up this investigation into the CIA with the question, you know, is the CIA a rogue elephant? Is it operating on its own? Is it making U.S. foreign policy? Is it getting us involved in things that we don't want to be involved in? But what the Church Committee findings really demonstrate is that the CIA, while doing many illegal things in the early days of the Cold War, many things, is that it wasn't doing them free from executive supervision, that more it was doing what the executive expected it to do. And so in this case now, I would say that there's a general tendency of the executive, I think, to accept and promote these programs. They don't really have a clear reason not to if there's not a great deal of upset about them, and they might be seen as doing something against terrorism.
So in that sense, the issue is not whether these operations are controlled, but it's really by whom. And in this sense,
exactly,
Congress has more or less been dealt out of this because it has been part of the steady growth of executive power since the Second World War.
And in some ways, Congress has dealt themselves out of it. You know, the accepting with the FISA court set up, is there is a Senate Oversight Committee on Intelligence, you know, a permanent committee that comes into being after the after the Church Committee. But there's a question that, you know, what came up after Edward Snowden released his files is a fairly bipartisan congressional reaction that was, they told us about this and we were fine with it. And it's essentially the executive is directing these things and Congress has, you know, nominal oversight, but how much they're actually doing of that and whether they could demand a greater role for themselves in the system. I think that's very open to question. Now,
yeah, though that's that. But you make an interesting observation that in fact what we have is a bipartisan indifference to these revelations. By and large, there are some people who've been very upset about this, but there doesn't seem to be the energy to try and reassert Congress's role in this the way there was in the 70s with Senator Church, which had nothing to do with international events. It had all to do with domestic spying.
And the funny thing about that is that Watergate, in some ways, represents some kind of democratic strength for the American intelligence community, because the reason Nixon is going to these amateurish, you know, private actors is that the FBI stops cooperating with him and the CIA refuses to cover up what he's doing.
That's a nice point.
I think the whole question of the changes of technology is something that I think is really interesting that I wanted to just kind of bring in at the end again, because I think this is something that is, well, I mean, I feel like as we go forward, we are, I mean, part of what this event reflects is this massive change in how we understand ourselves and what privacy means, and the sort of notion of private and public, and the distinctions that we've made for generations. I think these are things that are transforming so rapidly. I would hope that we would use this as an opportunity to really think about what do these things mean in this digital, increasingly global kind of context, and in a world that is increasingly interconnected.
But, yeah, and I wonder if we started off by talking about public reaction to all of this. I wonder, I haven't seen any information about this, but I wonder if it isn't generational at some level, that people who remember what a notion of privacy really is mm-hmm. are more upset about this than people who have grown up attached to digital devices, for whom having your personal information out there all the time is second nature, and they don't really have the same notion of privacy. So in that sense, 10 years from now, 30 years from now, maybe nobody's upset about these kinds
right.
of things, because
it's become
second part of our second digital nature.
I think that there's a very real possibility about the importance of that generational divide, but I'd just like to conclude my part of this by saying that I think there's an interesting historical parallel with what happened with the Church Committee, and to question whether or not we're at the end of a process or, partway through. Because before the Church Committee, there were a series of efforts following some of the revelations of, the CIA's activities or the FBI's activities to assert congressional control. And most of those failed. There weren't enough votes. There were several stalwarts who would try and get greater congressional investigation, and they failed until after Watergate and the Church Committee. So I guess my kind of question for the future is, are we going to go in a direction as to people not caring about this, or is this going to be one of the milestones towards a greater reevaluation and reflection about the role of, intelligence, security, and surveillance in our society?
All right, that's a perfect place to stop. So that wraps up this episode of History Talk.
And we'd like to thank our listeners and guests again for joining us today.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
This edition of the Origins Podcast History Talk was brought to you by the Public History Initiative and the Goldberg Center in the History Department at The Ohio State University. Our main editors are Steve Kahn and Nicholas Breifogel. Our executive producer is David Staley. Our website manager and technical advisor is Mitchell Shelton. Our audio editors and co-hosts are Patrick Patiani and Leticia Wiggins. Find our podcasts and more at our website, origins.osu.edu. Thank you for listening.